sorry if I could interrupt. I don't know if this will be covered in today's lecture. If so, ignore me. But could you please go over the answer to question one in the tutorial, like what the second order correction to the energy is in the degenerate case?
Yes, please.
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. I'll go over. I have posted the solutions if you want to take a look. I posted it after the tutorial yesterday, but I'll definitely go over it today. So these are the agendas for today. Couple of announcements before I did put it on the learning goals because I usually forget to make those important announcements. First is that you need to visit the portal, the quantum theory website, and you need to fill in the checkpoints. And importantly, you need to give me feedback. So I need them because I need to know where I need to improve. Okay. That's for my, the feedback is for my learning. And we are going to revisit some of the questions from previous lectures because there were three or four questions which were like very interesting and you had a lot of questions about them. I want to revisit them and answer them in a better way. Then we are going to start with today's topic of quantum statistical mechanics. And we are going to do in a number of steps. The part where we are going to analyze the result, I am pretty sure I won't be able to cover it today. So I'll probably, and that's the most important and the interesting part. So I'm going to upload a video, record a video, maybe tomorrow, like my tomorrow and your today, and then post it on the portal and maybe over the weekend. I'll try to make it a 5 to 10 minutes short video, not beyond that. And discuss all the results which we are going to find in the lecture today. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll briefly show the results, but the longer discussion part, I'll post a video regarding that. Okay. So I'll first go over the questions and then maybe discuss the tutorial question as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question. So I think we don't have the lecture notes for quantum statistical mechanics. Like if you enter that.
Okay. Yeah, I'll post them. I did post them, but I had to remove it today because I noticed there were some typo errors. Like if you don't mind those typo errors, I can post them right away after the lecture. Is that okay? They are like small minor typing errors.
Either is fine. You can fix it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, but I'll do that. Yeah, thank you. All right. So there were three basic, like three or four, I remember, questions. One was about anti-crossings. And that was like a lot of discussion over there in the tutorial, in the office hours and during lectures as well. So maybe I can try to answer the crossing and anti-crossing things. Like there were questions, can there be crossings as well and why these anti-crossings they happen and so on. So this was the energy, second order energy. We derived, if you remember, and there were higher order corrections as well. And some higher order, and higher order will have like squares of the energy denominator and maybe cubes and so on and so forth, okay? So this is part of your homework and you'll realize what these order corrections are. But let's take a specific case of maybe an atom in an electric field. So the kind of perturbation I'm giving to the atom is, so this is the dipole moment, and this is the strength of the electric field, okay? I don't know with this floating. I'm sorry, I have to reshare my screen. For some reason, I have not been able to fix it.
I think I have an idea what it could be. I think it could be like sometimes the Zoom platform gets confused if you're writing on like the shared screen versus you're writing like a layer below on the notepad. like sometimes the pen can switch over. So like writing on the like the actual screen versus the notepad.
Oh really? And
like,
is there a solution to it?
No. I just know it's happened to me before.
Okay. So I guess the only solution I have to stop sharing and then close my OneNote and then reshare it. Yeah. All right. So I am again going to write my potential and I defined all these quantities. Now for neutral atoms, which do not have any permanent dipole moment, this term is zero. So first order is zero because first order here signifies the permanent dipole moment. And neutral atoms, they don't have any permanent dipole moments, okay? The next leading order to the correction of energy is this second term here, this one. And if you notice, if I consider my atom as just two-level system, they're going to be negative signs for these levels. Like for I, if I have denominator EI minus EJ, for jth level, I'm going to have EJ minus EI. So obviously they have negative signs. And the dark maps for these levels are always going to anti-cross. And by stark maps, I mean I'm drawing the energy versus electric field. So electric field map. I'm going to show you in a while how we do that, okay? Because V here is D dot E, and if I take electric field outside, like this proper way of doing it, I'm just simplifying things here. So I have E square, okay? So if I increase the electric field, I'll get some shifts in levels, and the shifts in level for ith and jth level are always going to be in the opposite direction. If, however, I don't have a two-level system, because usually atoms are not two-level, they have multiple levels, right? I need to calculate this sum here and see if for ith, the overall sign is positive or negative, and for jth, if it's positive or negative, okay? And there can be instances where they might cross. I'll show you how in a software. But this is all said about neutral systems. Let's say if I had molecules, like polar molecules, which don't have these permanent dipole moments as zero, they do have a finite dipole moment. In that case, this term is going to dominate. And if I draw stark maps for such cases, like for polar molecules, they might also show crossings depending on what sign the permanent dipole moment has for that particular state of the molecule. Okay, so let me show you how these stark maps actually look like. I'll stop sharing and yeah. So this is a pretty fancy calculator. It's called Rydberg pair interaction calculator, but I can plot these graphs for like lower energy levels as well. So these are the, maybe I should draw it only for, no, it doesn't. So it's drawing these stark maps for two atoms instead of one, okay? I don't know how to remove one of these atoms, but the stark maps are, is the screen visible? Like the font is enough for you to,
yes.
See these numbers? Okay. So these quantum numbers, like it's for N, L, and S state, these stark maps. And as you see here in the x-axis, you have electric fields. And if I zoom in, maybe this particular area, so maybe minus two, zero. You might see, I do have some places where these shifts in energy level, they cross, and there are instances where they anti-cross, okay? So I just wanted to show that, yeah, there are systems where crossings and anti-crossings, they to exit. Rachel, am I pronouncing the name right, Rachel?
Yes, yes, perfect.
Okay, okay. So she did, she and her group, they were discussing and they came up with the question that are there instances when, like, when we talked about degenerate systems, we said that if I introduce perturbation, degeneracy breaks, right? So the question was, are there instances that we have, like I have a non-degenerate system and I apply some kind of perturbation and they become degenerate? So I think, like, this is the answer I can think to my best of my knowledge, that yeah, there are. Like, for example, if you look at these crossings, they signify degeneracy. Like, there are two states with same energy, right? And initially they might have been non-degenerate. And when I'm applying electric field at one particular instance, their energies, they become same. So does that answer your question, Rachel? And yeah, does that satisfy you?
Bindiya.
Yeah.
Does the degeneracy have any physical consequences? Like
Okay. By physical consequences, can you explain more?
Like, is there anything that interesting that happens when we have degeneracy with the energy levels, or it's just something that happens and it doesn't make much of a difference in how we look at the atom?
The way I see degeneracy. Okay, so I thought I'll keep that question for the office hours because there were some questions related to symmetries, and one of the questions that can I keep on adding perturbations and then there's no breaking of degeneracy, remember? So I wanted to keep that for office hours because that's a long question. But the way I perceive degeneracy is, like, there might be a number of ways that degeneracy could be, could happen in system. The way I visualize it, if I increase dimension of the system, that's one way of giving degeneracy to the system. So maybe I can again share screen and then show what I mean. For some reason, I'm unable to see you all today. I just see my face. So maybe Craig could help me with that. Okay, anyways, so I'll share my screen and then maybe try to explain what I think degeneracy might have, like, importance or might actually mean. So, for example, I have a square potential, right? And we usually calculate the, like, we solve this problem and then try to find the eigenfunctions and so on. You might have seen this picture, which is, like, not so right, but yeah. So this picture has, like, n is equal to one state and then n is equal to two, and there are lots of possible eigenfunctions. So this is a non-degenerate system. There's only one way I can have these energies. The way I see degeneracy is, like, if I introduce another dimension to the system, then I might have a case where the total energy of the system, it remains same, but there are two possible ways of doing that, right? And this is, like, kind of a symmetric two-dimensional problem, but in this case, the they are same, right? But it's not necessary that the potential has to be symmetric. I could have used a potential where the dimension could have been A in X direction and in Y direction, it could have been, like, from 0 to 2A. Even then I could have had a system. So NX squared plus NY squared by 4. So there are possible ways of getting same energy, but two different combinations of the state of the system, right? But yeah. There are different ways of doing it. And I think Rachel, she tried to related with the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, which I think might be right. Like, if the system is, if the Hamiltonian is symmetric, and that's not my expertise. Like, I've never done symmetries as a mathematical concept. I just know symmetry in spatial, like in space. I just know symmetry. I just visualize it that way. So, but I think that might be true. And I will have to talk to some expert who knows about these symmetric groups and all that, if that is true. But just thinking of it, I think, yes, that might be true, that degeneracy could be related to the symmetry of the, like, symmetric group of the Hamiltonian or something like that. And when I introduce a perturbation, then I might be breaking the symmetry of the system. And this brings back, okay, so is that, like, this is the only way I think I visualize degeneracy and not more than this? Maybe you can discuss more and there could be a more exciting answer to it. I don't know. We can discuss about this more, maybe during tutorials. Is that going to work?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, that's something to discuss. Like, what's so special about degeneracy? But my answer is just like, if I add some dimension to the system, I might get some degenerate system. And coming back to the symmetry and all, there was a question that, is there a way that I keep on adding higher and higher order corrections to my system and still I cannot break the degeneracy? And I realized we had a question in tutorial, like we had this potential, right? Question number 2, if you remember. And we were, and A and B. And the unperturbed eigenstates were E1, E1 and E2. So the first two states were degenerate. And the third state was non-degenerate. And then if you apply the first order degeneracy to the system, you'll notice that the, like, first order correction to the system, the degeneracy is not going to break because these matrix elements, they are zero here. Like, first order correction, they involve immediate transitions, right? So something of that sort, like if this is state 1, 2, and 3, then the first order correction, it involves some transitions like this, if you remember from our formulas. So these, since these matrix elements or these transitions are not happening because of this kind of perturbation, the degeneracy to first order is not breaking. But these matrix elements here, which signify that the third state is also affecting one, like the non-degenerate state is also affecting the degenerate one, you can say that the correction is to the second, is coming into the picture to the second order, because second order, it involves two kind of transitions. So something of this sort. Okay. And so I was just thinking if I could formulate a potential of this kind where I just keep on adding higher and higher order corrections, and the system doesn't break the degeneracy, and only potential form I could think of was an identity or maybe something of this kind. Because such kind of potential, like the physical, if you want to visualize this potential, would be maybe again a infinite square well, and then lifting that square by a constant V naught amount. So such kind of potential is not going to affect the system to any order of the degeneracy. I mean, this is not a degenerate system. If it was a 3D or a 2D, then it would have been. But 3D or 2D potential and then lifting it by the same constant amount might be one of the systems where you keep on adding higher and higher and higher order of corrections and you still don't lift the degeneracy of the system. And this was idea, I must thank Vincent for it, because one of our office hours, we were discussing and when we came up with this solution. So I'm done with explaining the second question, which I couldn't answer in my last lecture, like if there is a potential of this kind. Does this answer that question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then there was a question by Alexandra, like she didn't, she was kind of trying to convince her, but I wasn't convinced that she was convinced. And I think I think Vincent has had the same question, that when we were trying to formulate the formal development, if you remember, of perturbation theory, we're trying to formulate this expansion, I had written Schrodinger equation in this form. And then we said that I could inverse this operator and act on this state, which is going to give me a new state. And I can do that as long as this state doesn't have any component along n naught direction. And then I also introduce a complementary projection operator, which acted on the entire eigenstate except for n naught, if you remember. So the question was that since this state already doesn't have any contribution, like it doesn't have any projection or along this n naught, why do we need this after, like, there's no need to introduce it, right? So I tried to explain, but I wasn't like clear enough. I'll try to approach this in a different way and maybe write my n as 1 over E n naught minus H naught. Okay. Now, my argument of introducing such kind of summation would be that I know, or maybe I want to write my perturbed state as an expansion of my basis set, which is the basis set of my unperturbed states, right? So maybe I should write K, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. So do you all agree with this?
Yes.
Okay, so if I wouldn't want to do that, I want to write my N as an expansion N naught, I could introduce, since I want to write N in basis of my N naught, I mean, one of the tricks to do that, or maybe not tricks, one of the way to do that is to introduce the concept of completeness theorem, if you are aware of that, that is I, right? So I can introduce this here somewhere. Now, here I am not excluding any of these states. So this is the complete basis set. It includes my n states as well, okay? So I can write my equation A as, and this is not good. I have to stop sharing and then, I'm sorry. So I have to rewrite the equation again. And I can break my summation into two parts. and same thing repeated, okay? And dot, 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 okay. So if you look at this part in lecture, we had proof that this state does not have any component along N naught, so this inner product should be zero. And I end up with the same result, which was done in class. But again, just to summarize, the purpose of introducing this summation was only the fact that I wanted to write my state as in the terms of my basis set, that's all. So Alexandra, do you feel happy about this now?
Yes, and that was today's report. Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I think that's all. And there's something related to symmetries, which again, I said, I'm not so confident about answering when it comes to symmetries as a group or something like that. Other than that, you had a question related to tutorial, right? So let me see if I have that question because I was explaining it to one of the groups. So maybe I can quickly go over it. Yeah. Okay, saves time. I don't have to write it. So this is the second order equation. And one of the groups, they said that they also have this kind of term, but I convinced them that this type of term should go to zero. I'll explain why if somebody wants.
Yes, please.
Okay. So this term has L prime, like the first order correction, not L prime. And I can write L primes as, so I can expand my first order corrections as in terms of my basis set. And now by the same argument, which I just shared just now, I have to exclude all my states which have same energy as the degenerate space, right? So same energy as M naught and N naught in this case. Okay, so this is my state L, and it has two like degeneracy. It's something exactly what we did in our lecture. We had a psi state and we wrote it in terms of these two degenerate states, psi A and psi B. Okay. So by same argument, which I just showed that I have to exclude these states which have same energy as my L, I can expand my L1 or the first order correction like this. Okay. Now, if I do that and take inner product with one of the degenerate states, remember in class also we did the same thing. So I'm just following exactly the same steps we did in class for the first order. We first wrote the first order correction term, and then we took an inner product with one of the degenerate states, which was psi A. Now in this case, I'm assuming the inner the state is M naught. So I'm taking inner product with M naught. If I do that, this particular term here should be zero because M is one of the degenerate states and L1 excludes all the degenerate states. Okay? Is that fine? Okay, great. So I'll just show you that this term also goes to zero when I take product inner product with M naught, because H naught is going to act on M naught, and then this is E naught minus E naught. So this term also goes to zero. What I'm left with this expression here, and if you remember in my tutorial as well, in my lecture as well, I said that maybe the starting point for you should be this particular equation. And if I start from this particular equation, I can write my L once as an expansion in terms of my L naughts, which is exactly like this here, what I did here. I just substituted values for CK. I do that. Now, if you remember in class, the next step which we did after taking inner product with one of my degenerate states, psi A or M naught here, we had expanded L naught in terms of the degenerate state. So we wrote in class, we wrote psi A as alpha psi A. And so following the same same trick. I write L naught as a linear combination of my degenerate states. Just do a little bit of mathematics, and I would exactly get the same kind of results I got in class. Like I got something like this, where WAs were the matrix elements. But in this case, my WAs won't be a single matrix element, but they'll be like product of two matrix elements. Okay? And same thing can be done with N naught or psi B naught. If I take inner product with this, I'll get two equations, and this is my eigenvalue equation, which I need to solve, which is going to give me the correct eigenfunctions where my starting point for my like question should be. And the confusion was that when I get these linear combinations, these are not the corrections in my energies. So for the first order correction, when we found out the correct linear combinations, they were not psi ones. They were not the perturbed states. They were the initial states of my system to start my calculation with. That was a confusing point one of the group had. So maybe when I get these psi's are not the second order correction to my states. No, they are the psi's I should start my calculation with. Okay. This was pretty quick. Like I had to go over it quickly because I want to cover other stuff. But if you still have doubt, I'll share this, maybe a prettier version of it. This is too ugly. I'll post it on the portal, okay? Can we move ahead with today's lecture? Okay. All right, so quantum statistical mechanics. And so when we are talking about quantum statistical mechanics, we are talking about not just single system, but number of systems together. And they can be distinguishable or they could be indistinguishable. And indistinguishable are like of two kinds, fermions and bosons. We all know that. But like how the basic difference is that like if I have like two particles, okay, and one is at a distance r1, one is at a distance r2 from the origin, it is in substate A and substate B. Now if I want to write the combined wave function for the system, I would say psi r1 r2 could write it as a product of these two states as long as they are not interacting. So there's no correlation between them. Okay. And this is what we are going to assume. We are going to assume a system of non-interacting particles. And I can do that for distinguishable particles because I would know where the particle is, like psi A is at R1 and psi B is at R2, they are distinguishable. But for non-distinguishable particles, or I could have two possibilities. One could be these, and you're just aware of this. I'm just quickly trying to make you comfortable with the fact that what are fermions and what are bosons, like basic difference between them. Or there could be a minus sign here, depending on whether I'm talking about boson or I'm talking about fermion, okay? And bosons are spin, integral spin, fermions are half integral spin. You all know these concepts, but that's not the main thing we want to study. What we want to study is, I want to see how these particles, they arrange themselves at a finite temperature. So if I have a box and I have number of molecules in that box, and the box has a finite temperature, it's in thermal equilibrium, then how the molecules are going to arrange themselves in the different allowed energy states, okay? And this arrangement is going to depend, it's going to be different for distinguishable particles And it's going to be different for non-distinguishable particles. Like, it's for a good reason, because these are, like, I can say they are A and B here. I cannot say they are A and B. I'll just say they are A and A's, right? And also, but for non-distinguishable, fermions are going to arrange themselves in a different way, and bosons are going to arrange themselves in a different way for obvious reasons, because they have different characteristics, right? So what we want is, we want to see the arrangement of these particles at a finite temperature. And at absolute zero, they might tend to occupy the lowest configuration, which makes sense. Like, they want to have the lowest energies. But as temperature increases, thermal activity is going to increase. And they might start to excite or populate different states, right? Now, in the lecture on Wednesday, I guess, we did an activity where we arranged three different balls in a potential well, and then studied a number of configurations, right? We studied four possible configurations for arranging these balls, like A, B, C, in potential well. And they had a finite temperature, I think, 243, something like that. Okay. And then we found four different configurations out of that. And I'll call that configurations like O's, maybe. And we wrote them in terms of occupation number configurations, N1, N2, N3, and so on. I'll remind what this occupation number configuration is. So this occupation configuration tells me how many particles are in energy state E1, how many particles are there in energy state E2, and so on, okay? So for example, if by one of the particles is in energy state N is equal to 3, one is in N is equal to 5, and one is in N is equal to 7, I would write this configuration, occupation number configuration as 0 in 1, 2, 1 in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then rest all are 0, okay? So this should be, this should give you a clear picture. Now, in addition to that, so there are no particles in E1 energy state, and so on, okay? In addition to that, I would say that these energies, they are also degenerate. Like, there are D1 possible states, like the degeneracy of this E1 and energy is D1. So when I'm filling in N1, it has a lot of options to go into, okay? But the picture is more clearly if I draw is something like that. Like, say we have N number of particles. So I have N number of particles, and what I want is, I want to arrange these N number of particles in this particular configuration. And each of these configurations, the one particle energies are E1, E2s, E3s, with degeneracies D1, D2, and D3. Okay? Is this picture clear? Because it's important.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have
okay.
Any question?
Yeah.
Writing out mm-hmm. occupation numbers. Is it, like, say you have, I don't know, for some reason you have, like, a system in which you have, like, a zeroth energy state, sort of? So can
yeah.
it be customary to write?
Like an
yeah.
harmonic oscillator. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Then you will have an E0 state as well. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So what I want is, if you remember, in our example in lecture, out of all the four possible configurations, so these were the possible configurations, let me just remove and then try to write them again. Yeah, the configurations were 9, 9, 9, and I think, maybe I should write it in terms of occupation number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 3 in 3 particles in 9 and so on. Okay, and similarly, I wrote it for the other possibilities like 11, 11, 1, and my 3, 3, 15. And the last one was, I think, 5, 7, and 13. Okay. So out of these four possible configurations, this particular configuration had maximum combinations, right? So this particular combination is going to have 3 factorial combinations. And if I calculate the energy, or maybe if I calculate that I am drawing a ball out of this box, then what's the probability that I draw this particular state? I think it's going to give me the maximum probability, okay? So my arrangement of system is going to depend on which of these allowed configurations has maximum number of combinations. And this is my aim. I want to find out which of these configurations will have maximum combination, because that's going to give me an idea how system is going to arrange itself, okay? Is the aim clear? So I want to find first, my first step would be to find number of ways. So this is my number of ways I can, or maybe number of ways I can find, or maybe combine, or maybe make is a better word. I can make this particular configuration, okay? So how many ways I can make this configuration? And then I'm going to, in next step, maximize this. Maximize Q.
Vidya, do these number of configurations correspond to the degeneracy? Like the D's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. All these configuration states, they are degenerate because my system is at a constant temperature. So the allowed configurations will only be those where the system has that particular temperature. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to do it in two steps. Let's first work with the step one. And that's only for combination and permutation and combination, that's all. So let's work with step one for distinguishable particles. So what I want to do is I want to build N1, N2, N3, from N particles, okay? I have N particles and I want to build this. All these N particles are distinguishable. How many ways I can do? Let's try to understand that from an example, okay? Now, let's say I have maybe 5 total particles and I want to pick 2. I want N to be 2, okay? N1 to be 2. All right. How many ways I can do that? Okay, first. So there are 1, 2, 3, maybe A, B, C, D, and E. And now I want to pick 2 particles. Like, the choices would be that for first particle, I have 5 choices, right? I could choose any of these 5. And then picking second would be 5 minus 1 because I've already picked 1. So I'm left with only 4 choices. So in a general case, if I want to pick n1 particles from n, my first particle has n choices. Like I have n choices to pick my first particle, n minus 1 to pick my second, n minus 2 to pick third, and so on, till n minus n 1 minus 1. You all agree with this?
Does it matter if the order of choice?
No. So yeah, that's exactly right. So I have to divide it by the.
It wasn't 5 times 4 either. It was 5 times 4/2.
Yeah, right. I have to divide it by 2 factorial because I don't care in which order I pick the particles, right? Maybe I can show here. So for this particular example, I can pick the number of ways I can pick my particle is like, if I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I could pick 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, and so on. But here you see, some of these choices are repeated because I don't care if I pick 1 or pick 2 first, right? So these two are equivalent. So in a way, I'm dividing it by 2 factorial. The same way I need to divide it by n1 factorial as well. Yeah, that's right. So I was coming to that point, but good that you noticed before. Okay. Now I can also write it in a much compact way by multiplying and dividing the entire term by. And 1 minus 1 and till 1. And I can divide by the same factor.
Did you mean n minus n1? N minus n1?
Yes. Yeah.
And also,
thank you.
I guess for n1 minus 1.
N1 minus 1 and then n1, n minus n1 minus 2 and so on till I hit 1. Yeah, I think this is right. So if you see my numerator, it just becomes n factorial. And in denominator, I have n1 factorial and n minus n1 factorial. Okay. So these are the ways I can find, I can build this particular configuration. But now, what I have done is I have picked n1 particles and from a lot of n particles, I picked n1. Now I have to arrange them in, since in this configuration, this state had a degeneracy 1, remember. So now I have picked n1, but I need to also arrange these n1 in d1 degenerate states, right? For example, let's say I had picked 3 particles from my total lot, and this state, E1 state, had a degeneracy of 2. So these 3 particles have different choices to go into, right? So I need to take care of that as well. So the first particle has, so if I have like 2 degenerate states, these are my states, 1 and 2, they have same energy. So my first particle has 2 options, like 2 choices. And second particle also has 2 choices, and third particle also has 2 choices. So there are in all d1 to the power n1 choices, which I need to include in my combinations. Does this make sense? Like why we have included this? Or if someone wants me to repeat it. Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Do you want me to repeat it?
No.
Okay, great. So I can say that the number of ways I can have N1, I've not included N2 right now. So number of ways I can pick N1 and then arrange them in D1. Degenerate states would be n minus n1 factorial d2, d1 I need to reshare. I'm sorry. So the number of ways I can pick n1 and then arrange them in d1 states is n minus n1 factorial d1 n1 sorry n this. Now what I need to do is I need to pick n2 from the rest of the particles and then arrange them in D2 states, right? Now for N2, the number of particles which I have now are N minus N1. These are the left particles, right? Because I chose N1 here. And I'm arranging them since I need to arrange them in the degenerate states as well, and so on, right? So I can keep on doing till I hit the end. And in this expression, so this is my total number of ways I can build this particular occupation number configuration, okay? And maybe I can write one more to make things better. So the next N3 could be picked and arranged in D1 degenerate states in following ways. And so on. So now if you notice, these products are canceling. This is going to cancel by the next term. And what is left is that Q N1, which is the number of ways I can have this configuration, equals N factorial, these degeneracies, N1 factorial, N2 factorials, and so on. Okay. I can write it as a product. N factorial, and then product, this N goes from 1 to infinity, maybe, like that, so lots of particles to work with. Okay, so this is the number of ways I can build this particular combination for distinguishable particles. I'm just going to buff set.
Wait, sorry, Bindi, I'm a bit confused because if they're distinguishable particles, surely then we do care about the order that they're appearing in? So like we wouldn't factorials?
We don't care about the order in which they are picked. So there's a difference between picking and arranging. We do care about how we arrange them. So when I talked about, maybe an example would have been better here. So when I said that I'm dividing them by n factorial, see that example which I removed, I have them in lectures. I'll probably try using that to save time. So these are the lecture notes which I should be submitting to the portal. Yeah, here. So when in that question, particular question, when I said I have 5 particles and I need to pick 2 of them, these are the possible combinations. Like when I'm picking, I don't care about the order I picked in. I could have picked 1 first, and then 2, or I could have picked 2 first and then 1. Now, when I'm arranging them, it would matter like in which order I'm doing, but not when I'm picking them. right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, okay. Now so for fermions, I need to do the same exercise, and it's pretty, like, it's much easier than for the distinguishable particles, because in fermions, I know that they are indistinguishable. And secondly, only one particle can occupy, so I'm considering spinless fermions in this case, just for simplification, okay? So there are no spins. So the only one particle can occupy one energy state, okay? So in this case, my effort like reduces, because when I'm picking, this is really frustrating. I need to get rid of this thing somehow. I'm so sorry. Really apologize for keep sharing again and again, but I have no alternate to this problem. Okay. So in that case, when I'm picking N1 particles from a lot of N, in this case, there's only one choice, right? Because they are identical, like they are all A's till N. So if I'm picking N1 from these A's, there's obviously one choice. So I don't have to worry about how I'm going to pick these, right? All I need to worry about is, like, if I have picked N1 from this lot, how I'm going to arrange it in D1 states. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have one choice, only one possible way of picking N1. Now I want to arrange the picked N1 in like number of degenerate states. Since they are fermions, if let's say I have maybe I've picked 3 and there's a degeneracy of 3, then my first particle has 3 choices, the second particle has 2 choices, and the third particle only has 1 choice, right? Because once this is filled, the second particle cannot go into this. It has only 2 choices left. And once this is filled, third particle doesn't have any other choice, and this is the only state where it can go. So if I apply the same concept for N1 particles being arranged in D1, I would say that first particle has D1 choices, second particle has D1 minus 1 choices, third D1 minus 2, and so on till D1 minus N1. So it's the same thing we did for bosons, but that was the case where we were picking them. Now in this case, we are arranging them in D1 bins, okay?
Implicitly assuming that less than D1.
And then factorial D1, yes, because they are identical, right?
Oh.
So I have to divide it by, I have to divide it by, I'm so sorry, I'm not arranging these. I have to divide it by N1 because they are identical, right? I'm not arranging D's, so I don't need to divide by D's, but by N's, right? And then I can complete the factorial the way I did for the boson, identical part, distinguishable particles, and can write the number of ways N1 can be picked and then arranged in D1 as D1 factorial, N1 factorial, and D1 minus N1 factorial. It's exactly the same thing we did for the identical, this distinguishable. Only in that case, we were just picking N1s from N. In this case, we are arranging N1s in D1 states, okay? That's the only difference. And the similarity between both is because if I have picked one here, I cannot pick it again. So same concept here, that if I have chosen one here, I cannot put the second one here. So there's a similarity between both the concepts, okay? Now this is for N1, I can do it for N2 as well, same thing. And so on, I can write the number of ways my fermions can be arranged or can be built. Oh my God, this is so bad. Okay, so I can write it as a product like so if I have like a lot of combinations. Okay. Oh God, this is I have seen people using OneNote while teaching Zoom classes. I don't think it's the Zoom problem. I've never seen things floating on these. Maybe I could start using the whiteboard Zoom has. That might solve the problem, right? Zoom also has a whiteboard which I could share. Maybe for the next class, I would try to get familiar with that. Okay, so this is... and next, now coming to our case of bosons, which is the trickiest one. I don't know what to do, like any suggestions. This is not letting me work. Or maybe I can just use my notes and then teach from there. Will that be okay? Yeah, because this is going to take a lot of time, like sharing and resharing again and again. So maybe I can use my already prepared lecture notes and then try to explain from there. So for fermions, it's done. Yeah, for bosons. Now, for bosons, there's no restriction how many number of particles can go into a particular state, right? They can, you can fill n number of particles in one particular state. So there's no constraint there. And it is indistinguishable. So I need not worry about, again, picking N1 from the N particles. Like there's only one way to do that. So all I need to worry about is, again, just arranging the N1 which I have picked into the D1 energy states, okay? And there are a number of ways to do it. And one way you could say that this looks very similar to the indistinguishable particles where any number of states were allowed to be in one of these energy states. They could occupy as many as you want. So you might have said that maybe the first particle has D1 choices to go into, and then second particle has D1, D2 choices to go into, and so on. And by the same analogy, the number of ways I could have arranged would have been this, something like this, right? But that's not correct, because when we were talking about distinguishable particle, it mattered like in which order we were arranging them, because this is an arrangement, not just picking. So in this particular arrangement, we have, for distinguishable particles, a lot of repeated, like one and two and two and one. But for indistinguishable particles, since all are ones, one, one arrangement won't matter. So I cannot use the same concept here, okay? I can maybe try doing it in a different way. And one of the ways would be to, let's do one example that, let's say we have three particles and I want to arrange them in a degeneracy of three. So maybe three particles and these are three degenerate states. I want to arrange them. And I represent these particles by dots, and degeneracies maybe can be these states, or degeneracies can be shown by these crosses. So I'm removing these. Two crosses would mean three degenerate states, okay? Okay. So I could have arranged them like maybe all two all three particles in first degenerate state and none in the other two, something of this sort. Or maybe I could have arranged two particles in the first degenerate state, one particle in the second degenerate state and none in the third, or maybe one in each and so on. So there are a number of combinations, right? So how I can find these number of combinations? If you look into this picture, what basically I'm doing here is I'm just rearranging n number of dots and x number of crosses, right? So I'm just arranging n number of dots and d minus one number of crosses here. So if I want to write a general expression for how I can arrange N1 particles, N1 bosons in D1 states, I would have just simply said that I need to arrange N1 dots in D minus one crosses and arrange among themselves. The total number of objects I need to arrange is N1 plus D minus one. And the ways I can arrange N1 plus D1 minus one objects is N1 plus D1 minus one factorial. And again, since my number of particles are identical, like these dots are all identical, and these crosses are same, they are identical too, I need to divide by N1 factorial and D1 minus one factorial. So these should be the number of ways I can arrange N1 bosons in D1 degenerate states. And if I do it for N1, N2, N3, the number of possible ways I could reach this configuration for a boson should be something like this. I am actually not enjoying it because I think it's better if I write and explain. What do you think?
One thing I like is that you've got the explanation on the screen, so if we forget something we can go back and read it. But
So this is fine if I just continue the way I'm doing right now?
Yes.
Okay, it's going to save a lot of time, definitely. So I've completed the step one. If you remember, the step one was to find out the number of ways I can build this particular combination for distinguishable particles, bosons, and fermions, okay? Now I'm coming to the next step where I'm trying to find the most probable configuration. So most probable means the configuration which has the maximum number of combinations, right? So I need to maximize this Q in here, okay? And I think when we maximize things, we take derivatives of those quantities, those functions with respect to the variables. And the variable here is nn, because this is what we are trying to like change, right? So one way of finding the maximum value of this would be to take derivative and then equating it to zero. But remember, there are two more constraints in our problem. first constraint is that total number of particles should remain constant, right? It should not change. And total energy of our system should not change. So there are two more constraints. What I'm going to do is we are going to use the method of Lagrangian multipliers to maximize RQ. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to use the method of Lagrangian multipliers to maximize RQ using these two constraints, okay? And are you all familiar with method of Lagrangian multipliers? I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
Okay. But still, we are going to do that. So instead of maximizing Q, I'm going to instead maximize log of Q because see, Q has these products which I want to avoid, and I want to use sums rather. And I can do that if I take log of Q and wherever. So this is a monotonous function, which means that ln Q will have maxima at the same place where Q will have a maxima, right? So if I maximize this, that's going to give me the maximum for Q as well, okay? So I'm going to define my G function as G as a function, like Lagrangian multiplier goes this way. So this is the function which I want to maximize. And these are the two constraints to which the system is subjected to, okay? These are the two constraints, which says this is that the total number of particles, they remain same, and total energy is same. And these alphas and betas are the Lagrangian multipliers, okay? Now, I'm going to maximize this using all the parameters, okay, with respect to beta and alpha as well. But if you notice, if I try to differentiate this G with respect to beta and alpha, all I'm going to get back is these constraints again. So nothing new physics or anything interesting. What I'm going to do is I'm going to differentiate my G with respect to NNs, equate it to zero, and then try to find out the maximum number of, the most probable configuration, okay? So I'll do it for distinguishable particles, and maybe then we can take a small break, and you can try to do it for fermions or bosons, any one case. So if you remember, I need to maximize this Q, and this was the Q we got for distinguishable particle case. Now, if I substitute it in G, it's like log of Q plus alpha and the first constraint and plus beta and the second constraint, and expand this log, okay? So these steps are already in the document, and I'll try to go into details. But this is the G which I have after expanding, and now I can apply Stirling's approximation because I don't want to work with these factorials. And the one way to avoid these factorials is to use Stirling's approximation, which says that log of Z factorial is Z log Z minus Z for Z very, very greater than one. And in this case, we do have N very, very large, and N also very, very large. Okay. I'm going to apply these approximation on our particles. This is N. Differentiate it with respect to N, make it zero. I'll get this for my NN. So this N, this expression after maximizing my D, this G function, gives me that for a particular energy and degeneracy D, these are the most probable number of particles occupying that particular energy state, okay? This expression means that. Is it too fast, or I should keep going?
not too fast.
It is not too fast.
Not too fast.
Sorry, I have
Me
a question.
Yes.
You took the derivative with respect to like that, and that's one specific n out of all the possible n's, right?
I need to do it for all n1, n2, n3. I just did it for generalized n, yeah, n.
Sorry, what determines alpha and beta? Are they arbitrary, or do they, like, when you find all of the nn in this form and then you, like, have specific values for your capital N and your energy, then that determines the alpha and betas?
So what I need in the end is, I couldn't hear the question clearly, but are you asking about, like, what's the purpose of this NN? Like, what does it tell us?
No. So, how in practice do you find alpha and beta? Are they arbitrary?
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. No. They are something related to the physical constants. So, yeah, that's the part of lecture we are going to come to. Yeah. So I'll just say that similar calculations can be done for identical fermions and for identical bosons. Like, it's the same steps repeated. You just define your Q, which you just found out. Define G function. Apply Stirling's approximation. Differentiate it with respect to NN. And in the end, you'll get the most probable number of particles for energy state EN having degeneracy DN, okay? Because these are just mathematical concepts. I don't see any interesting physics here. I want to come to the part where we want to find these alphas and betas, okay? And if you want, you can just go through these mathematical steps when I'm going to share these lecture notes. So it's pretty much easy. If you can deal with the tutorial problems, because they were pretty tricky. These are just simple differentiation and taking logs, etc. Okay. So let's come to the interesting part, which is finding these alphas and betas. Okay. So these alphas and betas, if you remember, they were connected to the constraints, and the constraints were conservation of total energy and total number of particles. So I could mathematically calculate them if I know n's and dn's, because these were the constraints, right? N is equal to n, and so if I know these, if I know this, I could basically calculate alphas and betas because they were related to these two constraints, okay? So in order to find these, I first need to fix the energy. And n's, if you remember, they are related to degeneracies. So I need to find the degeneracy of the system. So I need en's and dn's in order to find alphas and betas, okay? So I'm going to do it for a specific case of an infinite square well. That's going to fix the energy. So let's say I have a three-dimensional infinite square well, which has energies h bar square, k square by 2m, and these k's are by nx by lx in all these three directions. And now, since I know the energy, like I know the system where I'm working with, I need to find these degeneracies. That's my next goal, okay? How to calculate the degeneracy of these EN states? Let's imagine a three-dimensional space. Is the picture big enough? I mean, can you see these X's?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a momentum space, because momentum and energy, they both are related. So I'm going to work with momentum space. And this is Kx, Ky, and Kz. Now imagine these planes drawn at distances pi by Lx, 2 pi by Lx, like all these planes drawn at these values, because these are the allowed values for your k's, right? So if I draw like parallel planes at these values of Kx, each intersection of these planes is going to give me one allowed energy state, right? Because each of these intersections give me a unique kx, ky, and kz. So it gives me a unique state, I would say. Right? And if you look at one of these states, the state is being shared by 8 number of boxes. So 8 number of cubes, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it's a three-dimensional picture, so 4 cubes coming out. So each of these states are being shared by 8 number of cubes. In other words, I could say that one unit cube in this momentum space is going to have one state per one unit cube. Okay, and the volume of this unit cube, if you see, is like in x direction, it is pi by lx, then pi by ly, pi by lz. So the volume of this cube is pi cube by v. So I could say that in one volume of pi cube by v, one state is present. Now, what I want is, I want to find out how many states would be there in a degenerate sphere. So let's imagine a sphere drawn in this momentum space. So if I can complete this sphere, and the sphere is at a distance k from the center, this sphere contains some number of particles, a number of states, and all these states have to be degenerate, right? Because this radius k is constant, and this radius k is nothing but kx square plus ky square plus kz square. So the number of states which lie on this sphere or this small ring of width dk, they all are going to be degenerate. They will have same energies, right? They have same k's. So what I want is, I want to find out how many number of states can fit into this sphere. If I try to calculate this small area, the small area would be 4 pi k square dk, right? That's the small area of this ring here. And this is the area of the entire ring, like very, very infinitely small width ring of sphere. So this is the area, but I'm not interested in this entire area. I'm just interested in the area which has positive kx, kys, and kz. So I'm just interested in this particular octant, I would say. Like octant means, you can imagine taking an orange and then slicing it into 4 parts and then dividing it in, like from between, dividing it into 2 parts again. And so you have like 1/8 of the orange. So the area I'm interested is only in this one and not this part and this part, because these parts have negative of k's, negative momentums, which don't make sense. I'm going to divide it by 8. So I need, sorry, I'm, when I'm talking about area, I mean volume. I'm so sorry. So I need this volume here. I need this volume, 1/8 of this volume, okay? Now, this is 1 by 8, 4 by k square dk. This is the volume of this ring here. And I know that in this particular volume, one particle, one state fits. So number of states fitting in this particular volume is, I just need to divide both. And this is going to give me the degeneracy of the system, right? Degeneracy of the system having this particular energy, En. Any questions still here?
Sorry, can you explain again why the volume of each cube is pi cube over v?
It's pi cube over v. Oh, okay. I feel I'm going too fast for some reason, but yeah. see, this is the cube, which has volume pi cube over b, because the length here is pi lx, and this is lz, and so on. So if I multiply all these, it's going to give me the volume of this cube, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And is this part clear, that the area here is only the, the volume I'm talking about here is the only octant, so I'm dividing it by 8. This is the volume of this entire ring here.
I have a question.
And
So it looks like we're not doing a volume there, like 4 pi k square. Oh, wait, is it? Oh, maybe it is. Usually, like, what, the volume of a sphere is?
No, I'm just talking about the volume of this small, it's very thin. You could almost say circumference of the, like, the surface of the sphere. It's, like, very thin. It has width dk.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. And then when I have to find the number of states in this particular thin surface, I just need to divide it by pi cubed by v. So it's going to give me how many states, degenerate states, they fit into this volume here. So how many states fit into this volume here, okay? Since I have my degeneracy, what I'm going to do now is that I'm going to use my case for distinguishable particles, where we had calculated n as this. So I'll correct this. These were the small typos. So if you remember, we had calculated n as dn exponential minus alpha plus beta en. Okay. So I calculated my degeneracy. I'm going to substitute this in here. And then if I take sum, in this case, an integration, because it's now continuous values of my k, I'll get an integration of this kind, okay? If I integrate it, my total number of particles can be expressed in terms of e to the power alpha. I'll find out e to the power alpha from here. Now, using my second constraint, which is the total energy constraint, I again substitute my value of degeneracy in here. And I know that energy is h squared k squared by 2m for my square potential well. If I do all these substitutions, integrate this, I would get another expression for e to the power alpha. Now, if I equate both these, my e would be 3n by 2 beta. Okay, this is my energy E. But from my classical, idle gas problem, I know that the energy for a gas or a distinguishable system should be 3 by 2 kBT, like if it has 3 degrees of freedom. So if I equate both these quantities, I can actually find out what this beta should be. Beta should be related to temperature, and it's 1 by kBT, okay? Similarly, alpha is related to the chemical potential of the system, and it could be derived easily or maybe thought of counterintuitively, like mu's are related to how the system reacts when number of particles are added to it. So it's kind of related to one of the constraints which we used. But alphas are nothing but minus mu by kBT, where mu is your chemical potential. And if I substitute all these quantities in my n and divide it by degeneracy, I would get the number density of my state. So this is number density of my state. Number density. So this n was number of particles with energy En, and if I divide it by the degeneracy of the system, what I get basically is that, like, if I have a degenerate system, how dense it is, right? So dividing these two should give me the number density of the state. So this number density could be a fractional number as well. These are integers, these are number of particles, but this could be fractional as well, okay? So it just tells me how dense my state is, like how many particles can fit there, okay? Now, in general, my number density by doing all the mathematics which we did for Maxwell distribution, Fermi Dirac, and Bose-Einstein looks something like this. And this is the part which I wanted to do, like analyze these results, because rest everything was mathematics. I don't have time. Maybe I can quickly show you something and then make a video to explain all these things. Yeah. So I had drawn these different probability densities as a function of energy. So on the x-axis, you have these E minus mu's, and on the y-axis, you have this number density. So I'm plotting this. So this is the number density, a plot for my Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, the distinguishable particle one. So these x are nothing but E minus mu, okay? If you see, if I increase the temperature, more and more particles, they start to occupy higher energy states, right? And a similar looking graph for bosons show me the same thing. Like as I increase the temperature, more and more bosons, they start to occupy positive energy states. For fermions, it's like more interesting because for fermions, if you see, at almost absolute zero, yeah, this is the way I could get. Number of particles up to one energy state, they are filled with like 100%, the number density is one there. And after one particular energy state, the number density of those energy states is zero, okay? And if I increase the energy, more and more fermions from the fully filled state, they start to occupy higher states. And this is called the Fermi C, by the way. And I'm going to give more details of all these three graphs. I'm probably going to use decimals because there's a lot of physics here, especially for the fermion and the boson case, because for the boson case, if you see, I would get a Bose-Einstein condensate right here. So all the states in the lower energy state, something of that sort. So these are something interesting. And I'll probably take a video of, and I'll drop you an email whenever I do that, because I won't be able to do it tonight, but maybe tomorrow. Any questions?
Could you please upload the lecture notes from the Sci portal?
There's some noise. I couldn't hear the question clearly.
I just asked if you could upload the lecture notes on the Sci portal because there aren't there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'll definitely do that. Yeah, because for some reason I'm not satisfied. It went too fast. But yeah, okay, I'll definitely share these notes and video as well. Notes I'm going to share maybe in a couple of minutes, maybe 10, 15 minutes. Okay, is that fine?
Maybe I can ask in office hours or something. I'm kind of confused. Like, I've always been confused, really, like fermions and bosons and how this all works, right? Because fermions are supposed to be like negative under exchange or parity or some operation, right? They're supposed to be like a flip, like when you exchange them in space, it should be a minus sign or something like that. I don't know how it works. Also, like when you add in like different degrees of spin freedom, I also don't really know how any of this relates to the Q quantity that we calculated.
It's going to remain. The quantities are going to remain same. Even if I introduce the spins of the system, you'll get a factor of 2s plus 1, ones in numerator and then in denominator. So it just cancels. So yeah, don't worry about the spins here. Whatever we did would be exactly true for spins if I consider spins. And related to the negatives and positive sign, it's related to parities. And I would be happy to explain it more if you like, not right now, but yeah, I can do that in office hours sometime.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, but yeah, just let me know whatever you want to know about it. I have office hours now, and I'll probably wait for a few of you to join.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.